It's not an exaggeration to say the United States has never had a president like Donald Trump. It's also not a stretch to say that Trump's last year in office was unlike any other. A once-in-a-century pandemic, nationwide protest, and a racial reckoning after the murder of George Floyd, and a presidential election that Trump and others have screamed was stolen from him, were the backdrop for a White House that bounced from one crisis to another. That year is documented in the new book, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year by Philip Rucker. He's a co-author of the book and senior Washington correspondent at The Washington Post. Philip Rucker, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's break down the title of the book, I Alone Can Fix It. That's a quote from Donald Trump when he ran for president in 2016. But the subtitle, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. You could have used many descriptive words. Why did you settle on catastrophic?
Well, it was a year of catastrophe for the American people. There's no way around that. The year began with the COVID pandemic. Hundreds of thousands of people died in the year 2020 in this country. But there were also catastrophes with race relations and the Black Lives Matter protests, the killing of George Floyd. There was catastrophe in the testing of our democracy in the aftermath of the election when President Trump spread so much misinformation. And there were other catastrophes as well, including with climate and the horrific natural events that we had around the country last year. And so it felt like the appropriate word. And the reporting in this book, Carol and I talked to more than 140 senior administration officials and cabinet members and advisors to the president. And we even sat down with Trump himself, and that what they described behind the scenes was indeed catastrophic. There isn't really another word for it.
There are dozens of stories that would raise eyebrows. A reader could pick any one of them from among them and say, that's not how I thought a president or a White House would act or respond to a situation. For you, though, is there any one story that sticks out as the most unusual, or one that would maybe say, well, that says it all about the Trump administration?
There are so many stories that we learned behind the scenes at different moments of that year that are in the book. But the most chilling thing that Carol and I learned in the reporting for I Alone Can Fix It is that things were a lot scarier at the highest levels of the Pentagon in the months between the November 3rd election and Joe Biden's inauguration on January 20th. We knew in real time how dangerous Trump might have been as he perpetuated the baseless claims of election fraud. But we did not know until doing this reporting for the book that, for example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military officer in this country, General Mark Milley, actually feared that Trump was going to try to execute a coup in order to stay in power. That is a chilling thing to think about in the United States in the year 2020. And yet it was real. And Milley, along with the other chairman, or along with the other members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is, the heads of the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, so forth, they actually had to develop a plan for what they would do if the president, the commander-in-chief, were to give them an order that they considered unconstitutional or dangerous for the country.
Very early in your book, you write, Donald Trump cares more about himself than what was good for the country. Is that the bottom line when it comes to Trump?
It is. And I'm glad that you seized on that line, because I think that is sort of a statement for the entire 4 years of the Trump presidency. But it had profound and deadly consequences in the final year when the country faced this crisis in the COVID pandemic. Trump governed by instinct, on his gut. It was a chaotic style. But the guiding principle for him was, how does this make me look? How does this help me politically? How does it help me and my family personally, financially? Those were the animating forces for Trump. He wasn't in there to do good for the American people, although certainly many Americans felt like the result of his presidency was good for them. and that there were successes in what he achieved from a policy standpoint, but he was motivated by how to help himself. And throughout the COVID pandemic, our reporting shows that Trump was guided not by how to save lives or how to help the American people who were suffering to great degrees, but by how to ensure that he would be in the strongest political position heading into the November 3rd election.
Yeah, I think a good example of that is early in the coronavirus pandemic, Secretary of Health and Human Services Azar was trying to tell Trump that this was dangerous and it had to be dealt with. And yeah. Trump was fixated on the ban on flavored vaping that the administration had implemented and how it could cost him the election, that he just wasn't hearing the people around him who understood that this was a dangerous situation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, Azar, this was, I believe, January 18th or thereabouts, was trying desperately to get through to Trump and to just try to make him understand how dangerous this coronavirus is and that it needs to be on his radar. And he had trouble reaching Trump and Trump was golfing. And then when he would finally get him on the phone, Trump erupted at Azar over the e-cigarettes ban because he worried that he would lose the political support of people who vape, the vapers from his coalition. And it just speaks volumes, I think, to how Trump was not respectful of the science, but also not prepared to lead the country and to govern in a moment of crisis.
One of the things that sticks out in the book is that this White House was a hostile environment. I mean, everyone was afraid of Donald Trump's reaction to what he perceived as not being positive for him. There was a lot of infighting, backbiting. I mean, is hostile a good way to describe that White House?
It sure was. You know, it was a very difficult place for people to work. And the people who did work there described it to us as hostile in our interviews for this book. They felt like, you know, Trump had fostered this environment where different advisors and aides were pitted against one another, had to compete for attention, compete for the president's loyalty, compete for ideas and policies, but also just compete to keep their jobs. And, you know, some kind of competition is fully expected in a high profile, high intensity work environment like that. And in fact, it can be advantageous for the work product. It can be helpful for the development of policy or for the government of a country to have, you know, a lot of type A smart people kind of jockeying to one up one another. But this was a different environment under Trump. It was really a viper's nest. And people were trying to get each other fired and leak incriminating information about one another. And it was really not the kind of environment that you would want as you're heading into a pandemic, a crisis that had deadly consequences.
What's frightening about that is that Trump only wanting to hear good news or news that made him look good. How can a leader make decisions that protects everyone, and that's his job, when all he wants to hear is what's good for him?
You know, it's an important point. You know, Trump loved hearing what's good for him. He loved hearing compliments about himself, and it meant that some of his advisors sometimes would withhold information that they knew would make him upset or that they knew would set him off. You know, the health advisors in the pandemic, the scientists, but also the political figures like Alex Azar at the HHS and like the head of the CDC, they had to make daily calculations about what to share with Trump and how to share it, how to couch it, how to spin it in a way where he wouldn't erupt in anger or a rage of fury or, you know, God forbid, fire them in that particular moment.
You write in the book that they were constantly trying to downplay the virus to the point of not even publicly releasing news that they thought would make the president look bad. I want to move on to the racial reckoning, though. After the murder of George Floyd, in fact, you wrote that Trump had a visceral reaction to the video, that he actually did react and was pretty emotional after seeing the video. But Donald Trump saw an opportunity to become the law and order president, a constant theme when there were protests, some of which did get violent, was to use active duty military. Now, He got pushback, though, from General Milley. But talk about that seeming obsession with active duty military.
You know, Trump was obsessed with trying to appear strong, trying to project toughness, fortitude, strength. And of course, the guiding reason for that was his political standing. He thought it would help him in the election. And so when the Black Lives Matter demonstrations were taking place around the country, including, by the way, right in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., all around Lafayette Square, Trump thought he could look tough if he were to send the military after them, if he were to use active duty troops to contain the demonstrations. Now, some of the demonstrations had some elements of violence, but people were largely exercising their First Amendment rights of free speech. These were largely peaceful demonstrations, and Trump wanted to send military troops after them into the streets of Portland and Seattle and Minneapolis and Washington and other cities around the country. He had to be convinced multiple times by not only General Milley, but also by the Defense Secretary Mark Esper and by the Attorney General Bill Barr that would be inappropriate, that this did not amount to an insurrection, and therefore the president could not invoke the Insurrection Act and send troops. And I'll tell you one thing interesting about this. When Carol Lenig and I sat down with Trump in March of this year for our interview down at Mar-a-Lago for I Alone Can Fix It, Trump said the only regret that he had from his final year as president was not sending troops in after the Black Lives Matter protests. And that was just really chilling for us to hear that he regretted not doing so. Mm.
Trump started talking about the election being rigged and mail-in ballots being a disaster during the campaign last year. Does he truly believe that?
He does, yes.
Let's move to January 6th. From what I understand, he relished the TV images of the attacks on the Capitol. What was he doing while that was going on?
You know, as the rioters were beginning to bust through the barricades outside the Capitol, Trump was watching on television and he was transfixed by the images. And according to our reporting, he was happy with what he saw. He liked seeing his supporters storming the steps of the Capitol in a show of force under his name. He liked seeing them waving Trump flags. He liked seeing them wearing those red Make America Great Again hats. And he was proud of what his supporters were doing. And it wasn't until things became truly violent and lethal, lives were lost, that he realized this was a dangerous act. And yet he stayed kind of AWOL. As the commander in chief, his advisors, including daughter Ivanka Trump and chief of staff Mark Meadows, had to come into the room multiple times over the course of several hours to try to convince the president to issue some sort of a statement telling his supporters to go home, which he ultimately did, but it took a few hours. And yet the president did not do anything to coordinate a response. You know, as the commander in chief, If a major part of our country was under attack, as the Capitol was, you would expect him to be resolute in his response. And yet it was Vice President Pence who had to do that duty, who was calling the Pentagon, talking to federal law enforcement, trying to get military and National Guard up to the Capitol to regain control of the Capitol. Pence was functioning in that afternoon as the commander in chief, not Trump.
Couple final questions. You sat down with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, as you mentioned. What's he like one-on-one?
You know, he's, and I've interviewed him many times over the years, he can be incredibly charismatic and gracious as a host. And, you know, he's a salesman at heart, right? So his objective is always to try to win you over as a journalist. And Carol and I are pretty hard-nosed, tough reporters, and we ask hard questions. And we didn't shy away from that in sitting down with Trump. And yet Trump, answered them with a lot of compliments and was trying to persuade us of his point of view.
One final question. Will Donald Trump run for president in 2024?
you know, to be determined. But I think if he had to choose today whether to run for president again, he would probably say yes. He very much seemed to us to be a likely candidate, somebody who had the fire in the belly for sure.
Philip Rucker, co-author of I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year, senior Washington correspondent at The Washington Post. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.